Evening, everybody. Evening, Tom.
Evening, all. Evening, all. Evening, Dominic. How are you feeling?
I'm very excited about the live stream.
Are you going to ask me how I am?
I mean, we were only just talking about it, Tom, but I'll ask you again if you like, if it'll make you feel loved. How are you, Tom?
I'm feeling a bit ill. I've got a bit of a cold, but I'm being a brave little soldier.
Well done.
Or I should say, a brave little sailor. Because I'm wearing my Nelsonian uniform, which was a present from my brother that was meant to get for my birthday in January, and it's only just arrived. But well worth the wait.
Yes, so, it's a shame that people can't exciting. See it in its full glory. But it's a really impressive...
Give it a twirl. Look at that.
Absolutely yeah.
Brilliant. It's got the... I just want to go and sink a French man of war.
It's a brilliant coat. It goes very nicely with your T-shirt, I have to say.
Yeah, it's a little bit hot. You might just undo it.
Do. And actually, Tom, you know, sometimes I give you a hard time on this podcast. Not often, I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. But... you deserve that coat because today you distinguished yourself with two excellent recordings.
Oh, thank you.
About
yes.
The, on Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates.
The founding of Baghdad. People who've been complaining that my impersonations are variable have a huge treat in store when Dominic's impersonation of Al-Mansur, the caliph who founds Baghdad, is unveiled.
Yeah. I mean,
that'll
it's the same
some excitement.
It's the same degree of acting skill that I brought to the role of Thomas Beckett, Tom, at the Edinburgh Festival in 1995. Right. Now, we should have greeted our listeners. So
hello,
we always
everyone.
Like to pick out a few people. So hello, Matty from Helsinki. Hello, Nicola, lefty lawyer from Islington. Neil from Waterlooville. Jenny from Adelaide. Jenny, it must be like 3 a.m. or something for you. Well done.
Yeah.
Anders from Nice.
All Australians.
Valerie from Amsterdam, Kira from Lewisburg, Carla from Portland, Freddie, who's from Sweden, Elizabeth, also from Sweden, Ud Kilty from New Zealand, Mary Kirk from Alexandria, we've got Anthony from Canberra, Michael from Baltimore, Wanda from Dorking, Jordan Pringle is here from Banff, Texan Wang, Patrick Carter. Patrick, I was in your neck of the woods not a million days ago. So thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Tom, what we're going to do is going to take care of a bit of business from recent episodes that we both wanted to talk about. So something from the Marquis de Sade. And then, as you were just saying before we started, I could talk for days about boarding
the focus
school
of
stories.
The focus of this evening is very much corporal punishment, isn't it? Which perhaps we haven't... we haven't focused on enough, but it's kind of weird coincidence that we had the Marquis de Sade and then we had that frankly quite unsettling episode on Tom Brown's school days that involved a lot of beastliness. And
see, I found that inspiring.
Canes with canes beated down with lead. Yes,
you've got to give a bit of oomph. I think Route 2 from West Worthing is in the house, Tom. That's nice.
And you know who'd agree with you on that is, of course, the Marquis de Sade. So one of the things that I neglected to say in the episode that we did on the Marquis de Sade, which was asked by a large number of people, was how the manuscript of 120 Days of Sodom survived the fall of the Bastille. Because what happened was that the Marquis de Sade is writing it on this in tiny microscopic writing. It's a very long piece of paper, very narrow. He's toiling away. And then about 11 days before the storming of the Bastille, he gets moved. He gets removed from his cell, taken off to the asylum at Charenton. And before he's not allowed to take any of his possessions, so he rolls it up very, very tight and he slips it into a kind of brass copper cylinder tube, and he then secretes it in a crack in the Bastille. And on the 14th of July, when the Bastille is stormed, he sends his wife, poor Madame de Sade, who's been having a terrible time, to go and get it. And she can't, because for obvious reasons the most decisive event in modern European history is happening all around her, and she can't get to the cell. The Marquis is predictably furious with her, says that he wept tears of blood at the loss of his great masterpiece. But it's been found. So it's been found by a man, and I'm going to have to read his name out because I can't. It's Arnoux de Saint-Maximin. And he sells it to an aristocrat in Provence. And it stays in the family for various generations. And then towards the end of the 19th century, turn of the 20th century, the family sells the manuscript to a German collector. And in Germany, there is a very distinguished sexologist called, what's he called? Ivan Bloch, I think he's called. And he reads it and says, this is an absolutely panoramic, encyclopedic record of every conceivable sexual perversion going. Therefore, it's a foundational document of the modern science of sexology. All very exciting. And this prompts the family of the Marquis de Sade, his descendants, come and get the manuscript back. And they bring it back to Paris. And then in the 80s, they sell it to a Swiss collect. No, or is it? What is it? It's no, I tell you what it is. There's a collector who offers the Sade family, they'll see how much it's worth, and he then nicks it. And then he sells it
to the
Erotica in Switzerland, where it ends up snarled up in a terrible kind of legal case. And somehow it gets back. Yes, a foundation in Paris then buys it. The head of the foundation turns out to be a crook. So the manuscript then ends up in a safe. And then I think it was 2 years ago, the French government basically bought it and put it in the Bibliothèque Nationale.
Where it presumably is where with the documents that are the foundational stories of the Da Vinci Code, Tom, if it's yes, in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Sorry, I was distracted during that by some of the excruciating banter going on in the chat, Tom. So I think the prize goes to James Marland, who was very excited when you said secretes it in a crack. That's the kind of
that's the Sardian banter that we want on this.
Yeah. Yes. And Catherine, yeah, there we go. There we go. See, it's nice, right, that your own mind operates.
No, I'm so ill that any hint of the erotic is totally bled from my
that's good in the live state. In the live stream. I mean,
yeah, it is.
Very good.
I've already slipped.
So the before we move on from the Marquis de Sade, to me, the remarkable thing about that story, which was completely unexpected because it was really your subject because you'd written about him in your book, Dominion, the remarkable thing about it was that it actually ultimately wasn't really a story about sexual perversion and whatnot. It's actually a story about philosophy and about power, I suppose, because you see him as an ancestor of totalitarianism, don't you?
Yeah, philosophically, I think.
Yeah.
And a frightening writer.
Yes. And I suppose the big question is, are you keen to do an episode or episodes, knowing you, it would be episodes about Nietzsche at some point?
Yeah.
Is that, are you pining for that, Tom? Yes. Probably not when you're ill. I wouldn't imagine.
Do you think that would would that frighten the horses? Would people want that? I don't know.
I think if it was
Nietzsche is an interesting
titled
topic.
Yeah.
I mean, think it would. Quite a good life.
Yeah, it is good.
Quite interesting, you know.
Yeah,
All kinds of legends around him.
I would.
The story of the horse isn't true, apparently.
I don't. What's the story of the horse?
He goes over and talks to a horse. He ends up talking to a horse.
Okay,
he's mad.
Like
not true.
Like Gulliver.
Yes, like Gulliver.
Like Lemuel Gulliver.
We were going to do that, weren't we? We were going to do Gulliver's Travels.
We still should do.
So we still can. Travels. We can do whatever we like.
I mean, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Titmus 312 has a very good comment. P.G. Woodhouse, Jeeves addressing Bertie Wooster. Nietzsche is fundamentally unsound, sir.
Well, it's not right. I think that would be a splendid way to open the episode.
Yes. Right. Now, talking of unsoundness, and some people are talking about beastliness in the chat, I do have some unfinished business from the episodes about the real Harry Potter and the history of Hogwarts. Some people say that these were sensationally titled episodes, and that we were attempting to cloak a different subject within a very crowd-pleasing mainstream formula.
The very idea.
Yeah.
The very idea.
That is a very cruel,
shocking assertion.
Claim. However, I did... Nonsense. The rest of history can't even spell. So I did have some unfinished stuff, didn't I, Tom, about school stories, which I'm obsessed with. So we talked a lot about schools, but I didn't get the chance to talk about my favorite school stories. So I thought I would do that now. And we'll kick off with a paper that I mentioned that will be familiar to all the British listeners to this podcast, which is the Boys' Own paper. Oh, wow. Look at that. That's my old school. Very nice. There you get your Gothic building.
Wow.
Tom, 1865.
You went to school there. That's
beautiful. Bring it back. Still looks like that. I mean, that's exactly how it looks. Malvern College. So I heartily recommend it to the listeners. I'm a governor of my old school, so I am biased, but it's very good value for money.
The chief of the CIA went, isn't it?
He was James the counterintelligence.
Angleton.
James Jesus Angleton, he went there. Denholm Elliott, Marcus Brody, he went there, Tom. I went there. C.S. Lewis went there. He did not enjoy it. I'm sorry to say, C.S. Lewis.
Why did he not enjoy it?
Poor judgment. People laughed at him for trying to combine...
Is he always walking into wardrobes?
Trying to combine Father Christmas and Nordic elements in the same story. Like Tolkien.
Amazing. Of course he was bullied.
Yeah, exactly. They said, listen, it's not consistent. All right. So let's pick up with one of the papers that I mentioned in the episode, which is the Boy's Own paper. So anyone who's English will have heard of this. This was the absolutely, by far the most popular, the central vehicle for stories, particularly for boys in the late Victorian period. So if you're thinking about the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, this is what people read. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, rest is history. Very typical. The Boy's Own paper, where are the girls? Actually, it was read by tens of thousands of girls as well as tens of thousands of boys. And there is actually kind of lumbered with the title. So it was set up by the Religious Tract Society in 1879. So here again, you get the preachiness, Tom, that you get in Tom Brown's School Days and you get in J.K. Rowling. And they picked this title and then they were kind of stuck with it. And they often went out of their way to say to their readers, you know, if you're a girl, don't worry, you can write in. They had lots of female authors. They encouraged girls to write in, send letters, enter the competitions and so on. The authors are pretty impressive, actually. So Arthur Conan Doyle wrote for it. Jules Verne wrote for it, Tom.
Do we know what he wrote about? It wasn't Sherlock Holmes.
No, it definitely wasn't Sherlock Holmes. So Sherlock Holmes, he would have been exclusive to, I can't remember where he first wrote.
The Strand
magazine. Yeah. Robert Baden-Powell wrote for it. But most pleasingly for you, Tom, the great cricketer W.G. Grace wrote for the Boy's Own paper.
I would definitely have subscribed then.
But at the end of the first decade of the 20th century, the Boy's Own paper is supplanted by, to my mind, an infinitely superior publication. And this, as Theo will now show you, was The Magnet. So this is the first issue of The Magnet, which cost half a penny. It came out in February 1908. Now, this was produced by something called Amalgamated Press, which was part of the Harmsworth media empire. So you will immediately recognize that, Tom. It was founded by Alfred Harmsworth, who is undoubtedly the most innovative and influential newspaper magnate in British
history. He spotted a gap in the market? And if so,
yes, he
had.
What
was the gap?
So what he had done is Harmsworth had already founded the Daily Mail in 1896. He founded the Daily Mirror, which was very much aimed at women, in 1903. 1908 was the year he bought the Times and added that to this enormous newspaper empire. But I think what he's doing with The Magnet and its sister paper, The Gem, is he is aiming it at exactly the same people that he was aiming The Mail and The Mirror at. So these are new readers, basically. It's a demographic group that are going to the new board schools, the new kind of state schools, and they are newly literate. They have more money than in the past. It costs half a penny, so it's available. It's very much aimed at sort of lower middle class.
And is there a difference between The Magnet and The Gem?
Not really. No, The Gem comes first, but The Magnet ends up supplanting it, partly because of this story that you have here. Now, I'll go into the story in just a second. If anyone is doubting the importance of these, I'm just going to quote George Orwell. You don't need to put the picture of Orwell up yet, Theo. Orwell wrote in 1940 that these magazines, he said, they are on sale in every town in England, and nearly every boy who reads at all goes through a phase of reading one or more of them. And he reminisces about his own time as a teacher. And Orwell says, all the boys that I taught read them. They read them until they were 15 or 16. He says, these were the sons of shopkeepers, office employees, and small businessmen. But they're certainly read by working class boys as well. They're generally on sale in the poorest quarters of big towns. And I've known them to be read by boys whom one would expect to be completely immune from public school glamour. I have seen a young coal miner, for instance. So this would be in his trip to the north at Road to Wigan Pier. I've seen a young coal miner, for instance, a lad who had already worked underground, eagerly reading The Gem, which of course seems absolutely bizarre that people from such a different...
Are these being sold abroad as well? So people reading it
no,
in Australia?
No, I don't think they are. I don't think they are, but they have imitators. There's no doubt they'd have imitators abroad. Actually, Josh Wilcox some time ago asked a question. He said, why would you talk about American schools like Groton or Andover or Phillips Academy? And actually, I don't know that much about American schools. All that I know is they're based on British foundations. I do know that FDR, when he went to, I think he went to Groton, didn't he? And he had long hair. His mother dressed him as a girl. And he was nicknamed the Feather Duster and was generally bullied and booted around. Okay. And then when he went to old boys things, people said he was a traitor to his class because of the New Deal. So,
Dominic, can I read you a question from Charles Corwin, who's asking, speaking of Orwell, does Dominic know that comic writer Alan Moore has the Greyfriars Famous Five become the founders of INGSOC? Harry Wharton is Big Brother.
I did know that, Tom. I did know that. And I actually like Alan Moore's work, like V for Vendetta and Watchmen. But when I saw that, I was very sad because I love the...
Let himself down.
Yeah, exactly. So the this is Theo's moved on to an unapproved picture. So Theo, let bring up, yes. So this is the guy who wrote that story that you saw on the front cover of the Magnet just now. And this is Frank Richards, or this his nom de plume is Frank Richards. His real name is Charles Hamilton. And he, I think, Tom, has a pretty unassailable claim to be the most prolific British writer of all time, which is a big claim.
Globally, who would be more prolific?
I don't know. Because when I tell you how much he wrote, you'll
see.
I know.
I mean, so many.
He's born in 1876, and he had been not to public school. He'd been to private schools, but not a public school. And he was very shy. I mean, he's pretty eccentric. He's wearing a skull cap, and he wears this sort of dressing gown and smokes his pipe. And he lives in a bungalow in Broadstairs, where Ted Heath came from, Tom. Mm-hmm. He is the kind of mainstay of the Magnet. And he lives on his own with his cat, a bit like you, Tom, except you're not living on your own. George Orwell said, it was not possible let's call him Frank Richards, though his real name is Charles Hamilton. He said, it's not possible for him to have written as many stories as he's written for this every week. But Orwell was wrong, and he wasn't just wrong, he was colossally wrong, because he didn't just write the Frank Richards stories. He also wrote all the stories written by Martin Clifford, Owen Conquest, Ralph Redway, Winston Cardew, and Hilda Richards. He also wrote as Sir Talbot Wynyard, I think his name was, or something like that, a brilliant name. So he invented 30 different fictional schools. Every year, for 30 years, he wrote at least 1.5 million words a year, and sometimes far more than that. So that's the equivalent of about 20 novels. And critics who've written about him estimate that he probably wrote in his lifetime the equivalent of almost 1,000 novels.
Yeah, I mean, that's very impressive.
That's very impressive. So his big...
But that's all shame.
So his big character that he starts with, and now you can bring him up, Theo, is Harry Wharton. So here's Harry looking, he's actually looking pretty loathsome, I think, there, Tom.
Yeah, a massive smirk.
Yeah, he's very pleased with himself. So in that first issue of The Magnet that we saw a couple of slides ago, 1908, it's a very, very Tom Brown School Days story. So Harry is, he's an orphan. He's a clever boy, but he's become a bit willful. So his uncle sends him away to Greyfriars.
So he's very like Tom Brown.
Like Tom Brown, except he's a bit like Harry Potter in this regard. He goes on the train. So the first story is mainly him going on the train, actually. He goes on the train and he meets a boy called Frank Nugent, who's also a big character in these stories. And he's going off to Greyfriars too. They have a fight on the train on the first trial. And there's this absolutely magnificent line. Harry Wharton loses the fight. And the narrator says, it was the first time Harry Wharton had been licked. but licked he now was, without a doubt about it. It was a new experience and a painful one. So Harry has been licked. And he doesn't like it. Go on, Tom.
I've just wanted to, Valerie's excellent point that 1.5 million words sounds like one of Dominic's books. So just throwing that into the mix. Very good joke. Does.
Very good. It's about a third of one of my books, to be fair.
And Thomas Cottrell's made the same joke. So excellent.
Golly. Yeah, this is good. Keep this coming, please. So Harry's been licked. He doesn't like it. He tries to run away from school and he's attacked by a footpad and he's saved. Who saves him, Tom? Who should save him? Frank Nugent.
Not W.G. Grace or?
No, same boy in the train. And at the end of the book, end of the story, Frank says, come back with me to Greyfriars. We'll keep all this dark and make a fresh start. Make up your mind to it, old fellow. And I can promise you that you'll find Greyfriars a ripping place.
So do they end up tremendous pals?
They do. And the last line, lovely. Harry Wharton faced his difficulties again to fight his battle out with a true chum at his side to help him to win.
Oh, wizard.
And of course, if anything ever went wrong, Frank could just lick him again, I suppose, Tom. And
then
it would be fine. So that's all very Tom Brown. And actually not all that exciting. But what makes these stories so distinctive and remarkable in the history of schoolboy fiction is this character. Come on, Theo, here he is. So you'll see here, Tom, that he's had too much fag. So this, the very fat boy, he's the fat owl of the remove, and he's Billy Bunter.
And what does too much fag actually mean?
Well, if you look at the floor, it's clear he's been smoking loads of cigarettes.
So fag as in a cigarette?
So that clearly is.
Not too much fag as in a fag.
No, because
obviously there are three potential meanings for the word fag.
Well, only two in Edwardian Chaucer's fiction, Tom. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Billy Bunter initially, he's just a sort of a walk-on character. He's there for mild comic relief. And actually, as time goes on, he begins to take center stage. Now, there's no character like this in Tom Brown's School Days or in any of the Victorian school stories. And actually, there's not really a character like this in J.K. Rowling or any of her competitors. Because the remarkable thing about Billy Bunter and the reason that he is famous is that, unusually for a children's character, he has absolutely no redeeming features at all. I mean, he is the absolute antithesis of everything that Thomas Arnold and Thomas Hughes believed in. He's often described as the owner of the tightest trousers in Greyfriars, as you can see there, because he's so enormously fat. He's cowardly. He's incredibly stupid. He is deceitful. He shouts Yaru a lot when the other boys are always booting him down the stairs.
Because he's been stealing their jam.
He's a thief. I mean, he's a consistent thief. He is a terrible coward. He is cruel. He is a monster, an absolute monster of selfishness and vanity and prejudice. Now, if he were a Roald Dahl character, Roald Dahl would punish him and he would be, you know, he'd be burst or something, like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
He'd turn purple or something, yeah.
Exactly. But Bunter actually comes on center stage. So he starts to dominate the covers. He starts to dominate the stories. And actually, all the sort of fine, upstanding boys are completely eclipsed by this extraordinary character. So the historian Geoffrey Richards, who's written an absolutely brilliant book about school stories, he calls him the schoolboy Falstaff. And I think it's well-deserved. Even Orwell...
Falstaff does have redeeming characteristics.
Well, Bunter sometimes has redeeming characteristics, well, hints of them, but you can never tell whether it's real or accidental. So at the end of the first full-length Bunter book, he's hiding up a tree preparing to attack his form master when a tramp, tramps are always attacking people in these books, a tramp called Nosy Jenkins attacks his form master and Bunter falls out of the tree and squashes the tramp.
Hurrah, and
Bunter was about to be expelled, but Mr. Quelch, the gimlet-eyed Mr. Quelch's form master, forgives him, gives him a box of chocolates, Yaru once again. And we never know whether he did this out of, as the narrator says, is it out of genuine English pluck? Or is it just an accident
because
he's so fat that he's fallen out of the tree? So George Orwell thought that he was a first-rate character comparable with some of Dickens's finest creations. His tight trousers against which boots and canes are constantly thudding, his astuteness in search of food, his postal order which never turns up, have made him famous wherever the Union Jack waves. So actually, there's your answer, Tom. That these stories did travel. These did travel. And actually, once Bunter becomes the central character, these are elevated. This is the reason for their extraordinary success. They're elevated beyond the kind of public school stories of the Victorian era. And they become increasingly baroque and almost extravagant. So as time goes on, there are all kinds of weird people join the school. There's a great cricketer called Dick Lancaster, Tom. He actually turns out to be also a criminal safecracker called the Wizard.
Who does he?
Yeah.
Raffles.
Like Raffles.
Raffles is a great cricketer and a safecracker.
Exactly.
So it must be one is influencing the other, must be.
It turns out that the headmaster is called Dr. Locke. His brother, Ferrers Locke, is actually one of the rivals of Sherlock Holmes, which is a nice detail. Sometimes the boys assist him in solving crimes. There are multiple school rebellions. So at one point, the boys barricade themselves onto an island and repel the teachers for several weeks. The school is constantly being invaded by external agents. So there's a brilliant story, which we got upstairs, actually, where one of the boys, Wun Lung, who is a Chinese boy, his father has been embroiled in a feudal struggle between warlords in China, and members of the Tongs infiltrate the school to attack Wun Lung. By the 1920s and 1930s, so we can see here the next picture, the boys are going on elaborate school trips. So, yeah.
The land of the pyramids.
They've gone to Egypt, and you can see Bunter there. He's eating an orange, looking enormously fat, while all the other boys are admiring the Sphinx and the pyramids. So in this example, they're being pursued by a villain called Constantine Kalizalos, who is convinced that they know where there's a hidden jewel. And so these stories are set. This would be a gift, actually, to imperial sort of post-colonial historians, because they're set in China, in Africa, in India. There are two trips to the United States in the South Seas. So basically, it's the sort of Anglo-Saxon world and the British Empire. And what, for a lot of historians, has made them interesting is Orwell's interest in them. So Orwell himself, of course, he was a public schoolboy, as you know, Tom. He had gone to a prep school called St. Cyprian's in Eastbourne, I think it was, in 1910s. And he wrote a very famous essay about it called Such Were the Joys, I think it is. And he described his prep school thus. He said it was a continuous triumph. Actually, you're talking about Nietzsche, Tom. Nietzsche would love this. A continuous triumph of the strong over the weak. Virtue consisted in winning, said Orwell. It consisted in being bigger, stronger, handsomer, richer, more popular, more elegant, more unscrupulous than other people, in dominating them, bullying them, making them suffer pain, making them look foolish, getting the better of them. Life was hierarchical, and whatever happened was right. So that's his prep school. Then Orwell went to Wellington. You know who went to Wellington? Theo.
Yes.
Theo like did. Theo, he went to Wellington. Presumably, unlike Theo, he was repelled by the barbed wire at the top of the dormitory cubicles, because Orwell said that he considered Wellington beastly. So he left Wellington and went to Eton. And actually, here's the thing. He enjoyed Eton. He was happy there. He was reasonably popular there. He was, of course,
Did he play the Eton War game?
He did. I think he did.
It's good, isn't it?
Do you know what, Tom? I have seen in the Eton archives Orwell's reports. Reports on things written by Orwell at school and things written about him. And it's clear that he threw himself into sport. He was well liked. And actually, if you think back to the podcast we did with Robert Coles about Orwell, he made this point that at the end of his life, Orwell surrounded himself with his old Etonian friends. When he was dying on Jura, it was friends. And he put one of the last things he did was to put his son down for his old school. Go on, Tom.
What? Which one? Eton.
For Eton.
I thought he was skinned. I thought he was down and out.
Wasn't he he was down and out in the 1930s, not necessarily in the 1940s.
What, so he'd made all this money from Animal Farm, so he's rich now?
I assume so. Go on, Tom, you wanted to say something. Fancy.
Yes, I was wondering if you have read this new book by Anna Funder about...
No, I haven't.
He was
so there's two books I want to read, which are the Anna Funder and the DJ Taylor, the new biography of by DJ Taylor, because he 20 years ago wrote a brilliant book on Orwell, and he's just written a huge updated version. Danny, boy dog,
that's a good,
the only
that's
footage
a good
of Orwell.
Fact.
Now, I did not know that. That is fascinating
that's
true.
That's a great fact.
Yes.
But the Anna Funder story is basically arguing, isn't it, that his wife supplied him with lots of ideas and he was absolutely horrid to her.
Yes. Doesn't this happen to lots of writers, Tom? I mean...
No, I don't think so.
Shelley, another old Etonian.
I don't think he stole Frankenstein from his wife.
Wasn't he meant to have interfered in Frankenstein and all this sort of stuff? I can't remember.
He offered kind of editorial comments.
Anyway,
I can't comment on a book I haven't read, but I just threw that out.
So to go back to the link between Orwell and the magnet, Orwell in 1940 wrote a very famous essay called Boys' Weeklies. I think we can see the first pages of it here. And he comments on the enormous popularity of the magnet and the gem. And he said, these and similar things like these that you find in provincial newsagents in Britain, much more so than highbrow literature or even films, he said, are, and I quote, the best available indication of what the mass of the English people really feels and thinks. It's one of the things I love about Orwell, actually, is that he's so attentive to sort of middlebrow, lowbrow things at a time when it wasn't at all fashionable to be so attentive to them. And he said these stories He saw them as pure conservative propaganda. He argued that one of the reasons that Britain was, to him, frustratingly conservative was that so many people, like that coal miner, the young coal miner who he'd met.
Like an Iron Bevan.
Like an Iron Bevan. That they were reading, well, the difference is an Iron Bevan grows out of it. But all his argument was that a lot of people never did, in his mind, grow out of it. And there's this extraordinary passage, very evocative passage, which is often quoted by historians, which I'll read, which is in which he perfectly captures, I think, the mood of the story. So here it is. He says, the year is 1910 or 1940, but it's all the same. You're at Greyfriars, a rosy-cheeked boy of 14 in posh tailor-made clothes, sitting down to tea in your study on the removed passage after an exciting game of football, which was won by an odd goal in the last half minute. There is a cozy fire in the study, and outside the wind is whistling. The ivy clusters thickly around the old grey stones. The king is on his throne, and the pound is worth a pound. Over in Europe, the comic foreigners are jabbering and gesticulating, but the grim grey battleships of the British fleet are steaming up the channel, and at the outposts of empire, the monocle Englishmen are holding the, let's say natives, he uses a different word, at bay. Lord Malevera has just got another fiver, and we're all settling down to a tremendous tea of sardines, sausages, crumpets, potted meat, jam, and donuts. After tea, we shall sit around the study fire, having a good laugh at Billy Bunter and discussing the team for next week's match against Rookwood. Everything is safe, solid, and unquestionable. Everything will be the same forever and ever. And that he's right, actually. That is absolutely the view of the world that these stories and so many stories like them project.
It echoes the passage he writes in, what is it? Is it Homage to Catalonia, where he returns to England?
Yes.
And he says, only bombs will wake England from the deep sleep.
The deep sleep of England, exactly. And he talks about that, and we're in... The Lion and the Unicorn, is Socialism and the English Genius, his favorite kind of pair of essays. you're at the club. You're gone. No,
OWJ. I think that's very true. Very true.
Surely Tom is Bertie and I'm Jeeves. I think that's much more accurate. But there are two caveats, actually. So Orwell was very mean to Frank Richards in some ways, particularly in doubting that he existed, because he thought he must be.
Yes, that's harsh, isn't it?
So first of all, Orwell said that these stories don't have any working class characters in them. And if they do, they present them in a comic way. And he's actually wrong about that, because there are three scholarship boys in Billy Bunter's year who are all portrayed very, very benignly. They're the sons of a chemist, a sailor, a cobbler, and a factory worker. Tom, only you could mention, what, four times is this now? About a scholarship that you presumably won before Margaret Thatcher even became prime minister?
No, I think it was, when was it? It was 1981.
Right. The Falklands hung in the balance, but your mind was on your scholarship. So we can see Mark Linley.
I'm so nervous about it. I vomited.
Oh, Tom, that's an... God almighty, do we need that detail? Let's see Mark Linley, Theo. He's the scholarship boy. There he is. Look what a lovely fellow he is. Now, you probably can't read it because the print is too small, but it actually says, it's a little profile of him in the magnet, and it says, Mark has come to Greyfriars with a stern determination to make the best use of his scholarship. Like you, Tom.
Yeah, like me.
Do you know what? I can't believe I'm hiding my light under a bushel as much as I am. You're not the only presenter of the rest of his history with a public school scholarship, I'll have you know.
I didn't doubt it, Dominic, but...
He's come to great. I can't believe we've descended into this abyss.
started it.
He's come to...
Talking about all these schools.
To work his hardest, to raise not himself but his family. He's never flinched. He's of the stuff that seldom fails to come to the front, stronger will and self-reliant. So actually, Mark is a tremendous fellow. He arrives in his mill clothes at the school, and he's very nervous. And actually, Harry Wharton, in keeping with his sort of Tom Brown persona, he makes a point of going up to him and shaking his hand and says, "We've heard all about you. Awfully plucky of you to go for the scholarship and get it. I've heard it's very hard." And Mark is so moved, tears come to his eyes, and he's struggling to thank Harry Wharton. Harry says, "Oh, bosh, give us your fist." And splendid time is had. But the other thing that Orwell said about the stories, which is probably in the 21st century far more damning, Tom, Orwell said they were racist. And
were they?
Well, there are stories. So I have loads of them. I have, for example, Billy Bunter Among the Cannibals, which is not a story I think you could, with a clean conscience, read to your child today. However,
imagine Billy Bunter would be popular with cannibals, wouldn't he?
Because
being
a boy
of size.
He's always been mistaken for a god, actually, like Prince Philip.
Oh, right. Okay.
But the interesting thing is this. Billy Bunter is very racist, but the other boys aren't. And in fact, it's very clear when you read them that his racism is actually one of his vices.
There's an Indian prince who is modeled on Ranjit Singhji, the great
let's have a look at him.
Indian in England batsman.
So here he is. He is Hari Jamsat Ram Singh. Again, a brilliant subject, actually, if you're interested in imperial history and in the British imperial imagination. He is the Maharaja of Banipur. And we are told in this thing, again, the print is probably a little bit too small. It will be difficult to find in Greyfriars a fellow with fewer faults than he. Now, the problem to a 21st century reader is that the other boys, of course, have a nickname for him, and they call him Inky. So he's called Inky throughout, and the narrator also calls him Inky. But it's not, it doesn't carry, I think, to the narrator, and to the readers in the early 20th century, my guess, now some people may disagree with this, but my guess would be that nickname did not carry a greater charge than the nicknames aimed at other boys for this reason. He's not portrayed as more comic than the other boys. He's portrayed as very bright. He's brilliant at playing chess. He's also very good at sport. So in other words, he's very good at cricket. He's a brilliant bowler. And he's very popular with the other boys. And actually, one of the things that really offended Charles Hamilton about Orwell's essay, he said, "I deliberately created this character, and I quote, as a comrade on equal terms with English schoolboys, because I wanted to rid the youthful mind of color prejudice," which I think is an admirable thing for him to have done. Actually, as early as 1910, there is a moment when another boy, I think we talked about this in the previous podcast about Britain and America, another boy called Fisher T. Fish, who's American, arrives at the school. Now, his two characteristics, this tells you really interesting insight into what Edwardians thought of America. His two characteristics are he's very rich and he's very racist. And actually, when he first arrives, he's rude to Inky, or to Hari Singh. And Harry Wharton again steps in and says, if you do that again, you know, we will bash you.
Race you in front of a fire.
He says, if a black boy ever comes to Greyfriars and you put on any airs about it, we will jump on you. Is that quite clear? I think that's actually remarkable in 1910. Mm. You know, at a point.
Or is it? Because I don't know enough about this subject, but I've always thought that. So just to explain, Ranjit Singhji is this very, very. He's a Maharaja who comes to England and ends up playing cricket for England and is an absolute hero. I mean, across the country.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that says about British popular attitudes to brilliant Indian cricketers.
Well,
it must say something.
This is a very it's a sort of deep subject. David Cannadine, in his book Ornamentalism, which was sort of written as not as it's not a riposte to Edward Said by any means, but it's a reaction to it. He argued that for the British, actually, race was not always the most important thing. That class and a sense of the gradations of class.
And so
really
therefore
important.
It matters that Ranjit Singhji is a prince.
Right.
I mean,
just
that's
as
the key thing.
Hari Singh is the Maharaja. We're often reminded that he is the Maharaja. Now, Stockwell Penguins rightly comments that they play up his funny foreign accent. You've got the wrong quote. Stockwell Penguins says Hari Singh has a funny foreign accent. He absolutely does. There is Frank Richards undoubtedly has some fun with his kind of strange version of English. But that said, I don't think we're ever expected to think that this either means that he's stupid or that he is in any way reprehensible or lesser than the others. So I think it's a slightly more complicated.
And are these stories all available now? Are they all still in print?
They're in print until the 1970s.
Okay, so it's not like Mallory Towers or something, but
is that out of print?
No, they're still very much in print. And fact, I think they've been extended. I think people have kind of written
new
versions of them.
So I think it very much depends on the author's estate. I think these they actually stopped producing the Magnetome with uncanny timing Well, I mean, it's not uncanny. It's no coincidence. They stopped producing it, let me find, in the week of the 18th of May, 1940. So at the point at which Britain's army was falling back on Dunkirk, Churchill had just made his blood, sweat and tears speech. And it was because of print restrictions. And the very last letter from the editor ended with these words. It said, "Come what may, we can always raise a smile. And it's this cheerful spirit that has made Great Britain what she is today." And that was the last issue.
Dominic, first of all, England 2-0 up.
That's good.
And Rob Dalby, who works at OUP, commends Ornamentalism as a splendid book.
Oh, that's so nice, Rob. Good. Yeah. Let's just, we've talked enough about school stories, but let's just end with one of my other favourites, which we didn't get to talk about enough. So here we go. So this is Molesworth. Did you like Molesworth when you were a boy, Tom?
Yeah, I love Molesworth, yeah.
So Molesworth is a 1950s creation. It's testament to the power of things like the magnet that people found Molesworth so funny. And I once remember somebody putting this, it was either on the Discord or on Twitter, and they were trying to work out which of these teachers we would be, Tom. So Molesworth is this boy who can't spell, and he writes the stories himself, which is unusual, because normally they're told by a narrator. Down with school, for example, as Richard Hindley is rightly saying. And he's very good. He sees it from a sort of it's with a schoolboy's eye. So, Tom, these are examples of masters. I'm trying to work out which one you are. I think you are the fellow who looks a bit like Hitler. I advise you strongly not to start ragging.
You think that? You think I'm a stern disciplinarian? I like
or are
that.
You, or
I'm
you
very
the guy,
flattered by that.
Are you the guy on the right? You may think I'm soft, but I'm hard, damned hard.
I worried that I was the one who cannot keep order.
Which one, that one?
No, brilliant.
So I think when whoever it was...
Which one are you?
You're bottom left, apparently, Tom. Surely you're the one next to him, Jeremy Corbyn. I'm keen on the latest developments in education.
Very latest developments in
education. I'm the one above him. I'm the one who looks like Stanley Baldwin.
The boy all look at me as a friend. Yes, I think that is you.
Right, yeah. that's how the club members think of me, Tom. Right, on that bombshell, I think we should answer some questions not about public schools.
No, you've enjoyed yourself too much.
Yeah. So, shall I ask you the first one? Theo has picked us out some questions which you've very kindly put on the Discord. Those of you who are still listening, the three of you who are still listening. So, this is from Lambert Simnelcake, Tom. Have you ever read a much revered piece of literature and thought it was utter tosh?
I think we've already discussed this. Yes. One of the kind of interminable novels by Henry James. I found it so dull. I can't even remember what it was. Kind of The Wings of the Dove or something. Or, oh, God, unreadable.
That's a terrible view. That's a terrible view. See, no, do you know what? I actually really like those books.
Really? I mean, the sentences are about four pages long.
They are. They are. And I find it really... To me,
and I'm not against very long sentences. I love a Proustian sentence.
Yeah.
Love a long Proustian sentence. But I find Henry James unreadable. And I'm not interested in any of his characters. And I hate his works with an absolute passion.
That is
and every time I see his books in a bookshop, I have an urge to take out a box of matches and burn them.
Do you hate The Turn of the Screw?
No, I like that. I like his short stories. And I like Daisy Miller. But I just, his long kind of late novels, unreadable.
No. Golden Bowl is great. Wings of the Dove is great. What else? The Ambassadors. Oh, look at this.
Oh, no. Now I've insulted JJ's great-grandfather. I'm
JJ's
so sorry.
His descendant. No,
I was lying. I love his books. They're great. Page turners.
I'm trying to try and think of my own answer to this question. Golly, a much revered piece of literature, and I thought it was tosh. I recently gave up.
I guess I didn't think it tosh, but I thought it unreadable. Which is perhaps slightly different.
Okay. Okay. The last book I gave up on was White Noise by Don DeLillo.
Oh, I love that.
Just wasn't doing
That's
it for me.
That's brilliant. How could you give that up?
I'd enjoyed Libra, but I just found it. I just didn't enjoy it. And also,
Toxic Event.
Yeah, Airborne Toxic Event.
Because that has the great story about the guy who's the head of Hitler Studies and his terrible secret that he can't actually read German. And he gets told
that's right,
that he has to welcome.
Organize a conference and welcome them in German.
And yes, and deliver. I think that's very funny.
Yeah. No, that's a nice
you
idea.
See, you're smiling. You're smiling at it. So you can't think
of
it.
The way I'm enjoying your telling.
Yeah, do you know, Ian Balls, Thomas Hardy. I've read Thomas Hardy, but I don't like Thomas Hardy either. I can't imagine myself ever reading Thomas Hardy again.
So here's the thing about Thomas Hardy, and I have a controversial view about English literature in schools. I read Thomas Hardy at school, A-level, GCSE, and I thought it was awful. I hated it.
Which one?
All of it. Because Mr. Chappell, our teacher, loved Thomas Hardy, and we did a lot of it. However, I then read Thomas Hardy again when I was much older. It was like a different book. Yeah, I think sometimes people push youngsters into reading things that are actually completely inappropriate.
I had a job in the local farm, just up the road from the village I lived in, and he had begun doing vines, Sauvignon Blanc, delicious. And I had a job kind of going along, pruning the vines, and I had the choice of bending over, which would give me chronic backache, or kneeling to do it. And the earth had frozen and it would slice your knees to pieces, and doing it for 8 hours, it was absolutely horrible. And then I would come back and I was stupidly reading Tess of the D'Urbervilles in an urge to improve myself. And that whole thing where she goes out into a field and has to pick potatoes.
Yes, yeah.
And I ended up reading it, and I felt a bit like I do now, kind of faint temperature, not feeling very well, and all that kind of nightmare stuff of her, you know, ending up in Stonehenge and everything. And I can't say that it was in any way an enjoyable experience, but it was a memorable one. Sticks in the mind very vividly.
See, I found Tess very moving. Where I do agree with our members, I very much agree with Peter Allingham. He doesn't like To the Lighthouse by Mrs. Wolfe. Now, what disappointed me about To the Lighthouse was I think Mrs. Dalloway is brilliant. I can't stand Virginia Woolf, but I think as a person, but I think Mrs. Dalloway is a brilliant book. And I think To the Lighthouse is gruesomely self-indulgent. So there you go.
All right. Another question.
Sorry. We're just whispering.
Actually, we are. I think so this is from Ooh, it's James, from Treasure Island to King Solomon's Mines to A Christmas Carol. Victorian literature appears to have had an outsized influence on cultural consciousness. Why? I am going to not do that because I think it is too like the subject that we've just been having. I think we can save it for another time. So Jesse, Ooh, it's James again. He's on fire. Which was more powerful, Rome in the 110s, Britain in the 1860s, or the USA in the 1990s?
That's a really good question. And I think the
USA, because it has the opportunity to destroy the world. I mean, that's power.
But it's not power you're ever going to wield.
You could. I mean, the Romans or the British couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton's never going to
It's literally power. They have nuclear power.
I think the answer is the USA in the 1990s. So first of all, Rome in the second century AD. I mean, Rome is a great power in its own world, but all through Rome's existence, it faces an equally impressive power in Persia or Parthia.
No, only once the Sasanians emerge.
But Tom,
Parthia also is very a weakling compared to Rome.
But also, Rome can't really project its power beyond its own immediate. No. I mean, you know, China. The Romans aren't going to do anything to the Chinese or to India or to...
No, you know, I agree.
They're limited.
But I would say Britain also is not really... I mean, its power is entirely dependent on its navy and its industrial power. And that, though, you know, industrial power is slipping.
Britain's
moment in the sun is only for two or three decades, really.
Yeah, yeah. And Britain actually does not remarkably... It's a very clever piece of sort of jiggery pokery to make people think it's more powerful than it is, I would say, for longer. So Britain was never a land power. I mean, the story of all British wars in the 19th century, especially something like the Boer War, is early defeats because it basically has no army worthy of the name, and then a sort of, you know, to kill off this sort of supposed underdog. So
I would say also that American cultural power is preponderant in a way that no culture has ever been before, because the means of propagating it are so enormous. I mean, you could see that British cultural power is greater than Roman, because no one in China or India knows anything about Virgil, but people across the world do know about Billy Bunter because, you know, the British Empire and all that kind of thing. But America in the 90s, with the internet developing, the culture of the internet is American. Hollywood is American, TV, you know, absolutely preponderant. So I think that's also a part of it.
Okay.
Good. So we agreed.
Well, agreed. Let's have I've chosen a question for you. It's Simon Girdleston's question, a friend of the show. Tom, you're being reminded sometimes by our listeners that you're, is this still a live stream? So we can hear every last
atom of
the nose.
I'm sorry.
See, if it was just me, I'd be happy with you to blow your nose as often as you like.
If I didn't, it will start dripping out.
Simon Girdleston, what was it about Ptolemaic Egypt that enabled it to survive so much longer than any of the other Hellenistic successor states?
The fact that the Romans could not afford a powerful figure to take control of it. So it was a great big fat item of fruit hanging on the tree, but no one was allowed to pluck it, because if they did, the risk was that they would end up in a preponderant position of power. So it was essentially, it wasn't strength that enabled Ptolemaic Egypt to endure for as long as it did. It was weakness, would be my answer.
But there was an answer before that, though, surely, Tom, which is that the reason Ptolemy chose it, the reason that he rushes away from his deathbed to get to Egypt, to get it before anybody else, why he wants gets the body, doesn't he? And the reason he picks Egypt is Egypt is rich, but Egypt is more defensible than almost anywhere else, because of the distances, because it's, you can only really attack it from one direction. You have to trudge across the desert. The defenders will have, you know, lots of advance warning. I mean, that he chose better than any of the other successors. Would you not agree?
Yeah, he did, but it's still not defensible against the Romans. If the Romans want to take it very, very rapidly.
Yeah. The Roman system been different, somebody would have taken it. Is that what you're saying?
Because the moment there's an autocracy, the moment there's one guy in charge, he grabs it, makes himself Pharaoh Augustus.
Well,
you know, and the measure of that is that no senator is allowed to enter Egypt without the permission of the emperor. The guy who is in charge of the military forces in Egypt is always an equestrian. It's like the Praetorian Guard. It's too sensitive.
Tom, Misty Mulvaner is slagging off Charles Dickens. We can't have that, and the rest is history. Okay.
Madness.
Mind you, people have been slagging off Tolkien. Everything else, I let it go.
No, that's fine. But I mean, everything else that that Misty has ever said or done has been absolutely 10 out of 10. But I think that is the one blot on her escutcheon. You know, even Homer nods.
And you've let Morven down, which is sad. Right. Tom, a couple more questions before you die of your cold.
Can I ask you one, which is quite an interesting one?
It's a furious
bearing in mind. Yeah, bearing in mind, we've just been doing one on Pinochet and the overthrowing of Allende. And Pinochet, of course, ended up being defended very stridently by Baroness Thatcher, as she became by the time. But Furious Camillus asked, many on the populist right all over the world use Margaret Thatcher's image, including Bolsonaro from my country of origin, so that's Brazil. Is there any real connection between Thatcherism and today's populist right? That's a good question.
It's an excellent question. Mrs. Thatcher is a very... She's very canny at using what you might see as populist themes. So selling herself as an ordinary housewife in the 1970s. She says, you know, there's a sort of there's an out of touch kind of left wing metropolitan elite. She sounds that theme a little bit when she's in opposition. But there's no direct line. I mean, they're so different. Mrs. Thatcher is so much more of a conventional conservative, center right.
She's very conventional, isn't she? And she's very kind of Methodist and spare. And she's
very, she gets very frustrated with institutions. So she'll often sort of say the people running them are wet and consensual and weak and all this. But she's actually she's very respectful of constitutional norms and traditions. You know, she's incredibly dutiful.
The low curtsy to the Queen.
Exactly, all that stuff. I mean,
Gillian Anderson did very well.
Very famous story that Matthew Paris, who's now a Times columnist, used to be a Conservative MP, tells about her, about them discussing privatizing things. And somebody says, well, we could privatize this, we could privatize that, we could privatize the Royal Mail. And she's like, no, 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 not the Royal Mail. You know, I think there's the difference between Mrs. Thatcher on the one hand. I mean, of course, they're all politicians on the right. Well, you know, you can draw a massive family tree or something, just as you could with politicians on the left. But she has nothing in common with Bolsonaro, with Donald Trump, with Berlusconi, with characters like that, I would say.
Because they're all a bit vulgar. And she wasn't really vulgar. I mean, she was.
No, and she's also, I mean, the thing that a lot of these people have in common is they don't do any work. And she's famous for, you know, staying up all night, studying the briefing papers, desperate to prove herself as good as any man. I mean, I think in that regard, she doesn't want to overturn the game. She wants to play the game and show herself really good at it. I think the thing with a lot of the modern populists is they regard the game itself as illegitimate, as tainted, as they want to smash it all up. Would I say the same for Reagan on the American side? Very good question from Lucas Judson. I would say that Reagan himself.
But Reagan has basically been rejected by Trump, hasn't he? That kind of Reagan tradition of standing up to the Soviet Union and neoliberalism and everything.
Reagan was an internationalist.
Trump has consciously repudiated that. And that's why lots in the Republican Party don't like him.
Yeah, lots of former Reagan people. The only thing you would say is that in the 1980s, the techniques that are going to lead to the rise of Trump, so the mediaification of American politics, the influx of money, the sort of Hollywoodization, those things had all already become part of the ecosystem. Of course, Reagan, we talked in our podcast about him making a real effort to kind of woo the evangelicals, the evangelical right, the kind of Christian coalition, the sort of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson type people. Now, they're some of Donald Trump's biggest backers, their descendants. So maybe there is more of an obvious. Again, big difference is that Reagan is ultimately, I think the thing about Reagan is that Reagan is, he likes playing the emollient, friendly, avuncular, ultra-patriotic small-town boy who's become president, doesn't he? He likes playing kind of Jimmy Stewart-type character. That's his instinct.
That's his
Trump's instinct is to be aggressive and to divide. And I think although Reagan could do that and sometimes did, I don't think that's his raison d'etre. I don't think that's why he's in politics. Mary Kirk, worth remembering, populism wasn't always vulgar, crass, and outlandish. I think those are often temptations for populism, for all populists. But you're right, it doesn't have to be that way. Of course, you can have a progressive populism. And there were lots of progressive populists throughout the 20th century in America and elsewhere. Tony Benn was a populist, by the way, in Britain.
Right. Should we have one last question? Do you have one last question? And then I must go and get some Lemsip.
Okay, we've had...
Caput Neely, addressing you, Dominic, you recently said that you went down a rabbit hole looking at war games between China and the US and Taiwan. How reliable have war games been at predicting the outcomes of other modern conflicts? Has their reliability improved over time? I mean, I imagine that you wouldn't know. I certainly don't know the answer to that. But I just brought that up because my brother's podcast, We Have Ways, and Al Murray's, did a wonderful thing about the attempt to see what would have happened if Operation Sea Lion had gone ahead. I think it was in the 70s.
Oh, yes.
It was the first mass attempt to, you know, it was a huge, huge scale. Loads and loads of people involved, massive. And they you know, they wanted to make it exciting. So they wanted to get the Germans to land. And basically they had to kind of gerrymander all the circumstances and kind of provide tornadoes and things and bolts of lightning incinerating British flagships, even to get the Germans briefly to land on English soil. And even then they were kind of wiped out within a few hours.
Really?
Yeah. And so essentially that seemed to teach a very clear lesson that there was no prospect really of Britain ever being invaded in 1940. And I think that was apparently the war game that encouraged governments across the world to think, well, there may actually be something to this, and start experimenting.
That's
with it.
That's interesting. Well, that's apparently a good answer, because I didn't have an answer to that. The requirement should be, it doesn't aim to predict an outcome. All right, very good. I did have a question for you, actually, Tom. Where was it? Oh, it's too big. It's much too big. It was Todd's question. Are the parallels between America today and the decline of the Roman Empire? I'm guessing although you're in the market for kind of 2,000 words in the Observer type pieces, you probably don't ultimately think there's any direct parallels. Do you?
Well, I've said this before. I think that there is a more than merely tendentious parallel in that the founding fathers were directly inspired by the example of the Roman Republic. So hence the capital, hence the Senate, hence a lot of the ideological language that framed the early decades of the American Republic. But the corollary of that is that America is haunted by two precedents from Roman history, one being the fall of the Roman Empire. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's but it's an absolute staple of you know, science fiction. People kind of wandering around the monuments, the toppled monuments of Washington or New York or whatever. But the other one is the fall of the Roman Republic, and that anxiety that Caesarism will bury the Republican order, I think, is has been an anxiety right from the very beginning. And it's obviously a certain shadow over the election next year.
Well, Tom, as people were saying on the Discord only yesterday, that is also the story of the Star Wars prequels.
Is it?
Which makes it all the more baffling.
The trade deals. I watched
the Trade Federation.
Oh, God. The thing with the weird kind of frog.
Is that Jar Jar Binks?
He's kind of long and he's got kind of weird ears. And
speaks in a kind of Jamaican patois.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's basically like the kind of the EU. I thought it was unwatchable. And
they're very bad films, those prequels. However, Star Wars is quite a good subject for a futuristic history. As I told you about 3 years ago, back when we were discussing doing the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And
I'd rather do the Polish-Lithuanian
Commonwealth. We are still thinking about it. You would do an excellent Palpatine. I mean, they're very similar characters, actually.
I don't even know what that means. Right. I imagine it's rude.
We should tie it up now, just to say a couple of things before we do, before Tom goes off to have his Lemsip. First of all, we are incredibly grateful to all of you, as always, for all your support, for your jolly comments on the Discord. Tom, I know you love a chat community.
Love a chat community.
And we're very pleased, keep all the questions coming. We love reading what you think. Thank you, Callum. That's very kind of you. Keep suggestions for episodes coming. Obviously, you'll be conscious that we don't always take them all on board because we can't, but we try to do as many as we can. So thank you to all of you.
Thank you, Rosalind. Thank you, Rosalind.
For those of you who don't know, we are doing a show in Bath at the end of October. I think something like the 23rd, Tom. We are doing a show in London on the 31st of October. I think there are still some tickets available. Yeah.
23rd and 31st. Yeah.
So those 23rd, I think, have only just gone on sale or are going to or something like that. The 31st, they've been on sale for a while, but there's still a few left. We have, for those of you who are in Australia and New Zealand, we will be with you in November. And we're very much looking forward to meeting you then.
So exciting.
We have some great, great episodes coming up. We have next week, the story of gladiators and the Colosseum. A story I read here of death, sex, and violence. That's what all Rest Is History episodes should be about, Theo.
A story of death, sex, violence, and concrete.
Yes. We have two episodes, not one, but two. It was going to be one and it ended up being two, about the presidency of Salvador Allende and the coup masterminded, or was it, by Augusto Pinochet in 1973. And then we're into our next big series, which is a four-part series about British politics in the 1920s and 30s, all around the subject of British fascism. And Tom will be talking about the Mitfords, won't you, Tom?
Specifically Unity Mitford and the question of whether what she got up to with Hitler.
And then that, we will be at some point quite soon after that, I think, we will be into the Umayyad Caliphate, the Abbasids, the Foundation of Baghdad, and the Arabian Nights. So lots of really fun things to come.
But with your stunning impression.
We shouldn't end with that, Tom. We should end with Sam Shearn, because Sam Shearn wanted to thank us for the message we recorded for his wedding day and thank Theo for organizing said message. But he does have to tell you that he and his wife were not convinced by your recommendation of a trip to Hadrian's Wall for their honeymoon.
Why?
So I think they've seen the photo of you dragging your family to Hadrian's Wall, which I know people never tire of seeing.
The outskirts of Newcastle, perfect place for a honeymoon.
Was it a garage that you took that photo? Just outside a garage?
Yeah, just outside a garage.
Very romantic.
Yeah. Very nice.
Nothing says romance and honeymoon more than cheap diesel.
I so the I just after I started going out with Sadie, I made her go on a walk along Hadrian's Wall, and I got the address of the bed and breakfast wrong, and made her walk an extra 5 miles, and she burst into tears. But you know, she survived that, and then she was
look at that. I love that photo. I never tire of seeing that photo. It's actually not so much the Katie and Eliza; it's this expression, the weary exasperation.
I think it's Eliza who's the youngest one in her kind of hazmat suit.
Just the utter gloom. The utter gloom.
Oh, bless.
Right. Jolly good. So thank you to all of you for listening. And we will be back on, well, if you haven't already heard it, we're back on Thursday with more public schoolery. And then we are back next week with Gladiators and the Colosseum. So enjoy that. And good night.
Good night.